1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 135, The Genesis of Gender, or Why Mother in Heaven Can't Save You, by Carrie A. Miles. And If I Hate My Mother, Can I Love the Heavenly Mother? Personal Identity, Parental Relationships, and Perceptions of God, by Margaret Merrill Toscano.
I'd like to welcome you to this session of Sunstone. This is session 135. The session runs from 11:15 until 12:45. We're going to have a feminist perspective here, and I'm honored to be able to chair. My name is Christian Faunesbeck. We're going to have two presentations. The first is the Genesis of Gender, or Why Mother in Heaven Can't Save You, by Carrie Miles. The second, If I Hate My Mother, Can I Love the Heavenly Mother? Personal Identity, Parental Relationships, and Perceptions of God. And then we'll have comments from Martha Pierce. We need to keep in mind that these sessions are taped, and so we have a wider audience than those just here in the session. And because of the taping, I'd like to introduce our presenters as we go. I keep in mind the people who are listening to the tapes as they commute and catch the speaker on Friday afternoon who was introduced Tuesday morning. So it's a little hard to keep track, perhaps. Carrie Miles has a PhD in social and organizational psychology. And her expertise is in business organizations, management, statistics, research methodology. These might have been classes that you avoided, so this is your chance to pick up on some of these concepts. She's an organizational and management consultant, has published in academic journals, professional magazines, as well as having published in Dialogue. She's also written a novel that's partly on the topic of the paper that she's presenting today, and she's looking for an agent. So this might have been the right place to come. She lives in San Jose with her husband, Larry, a professor of economics, and two children, and she mentioned that economics is going to bear on the topic that she treats this morning. So let me present Carrie Miles.
Thank you. I feel like the woman at the well, and my brother Alphonse for everything I've ever done. I came across an item in Parade magazine a few weeks ago in the Ask Marilyn column. Have you ever seen that? And Marilyn is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the smartest person in the world. And the question was, Dear Marilyn, I recently finished a book on the great philosophers, Why Were None of Them Women? Signed George S. And Marilyn replied, there are only two likely reasons. Either they didn't try hard enough or they weren't capable. this was a few weeks ago. Now, I remember as a child in the 50s arguing with someone about the same topic, pretty much. And the basic argument was, if girls really are as good as boys, then why don't girls beat boys at anything? Why are even the great chefs men? Okay. And I'm trying to remember who it was I had that argument with. And first I was thinking it was my brothers. And I realized it wasn't my brothers, it was my best friend. So this was coming from another girl. But the question being asked in both instances is a really critical one. I think for women, understanding what it is to be a woman, understanding our worth in the world, and even our religious worth, why are we different? Why are men and women different? And why is it that women is universally subordinate to men? You know, we've looked in vain for cultures where women were the top dogs for matriarchies. They don't seem to be much good evidence for them. Why is that? So what are some of the things that you've heard or seen or been told? How men and women are different. Women are more what than men? More nurturing. More spiritual. Intuitive. Women communicate feelings. Okay, how about men? Men are more... You want me to repeat that on the tape? This is not men bashing, please. Men are more spatially oriented. Okay. More aggressive. Competitive. Singular? What does that mean? Oh, focused? Okay. All right, thank you. Greater upper body strength. Okay. Okay, so there are all these things that we accept, or we've heard, at least culture accepts, that men and women are different. So what are the historic differences in power between men and women? Men have it, women don't. Oh, that pretty much summarizes it. Okay, I'm going to go on from there. Now, there are lots of explanations for this, and you can go all the way back to Aristotle, you know, 3rd, 4th century B.C. I'm sure they were talking about it long before then. I've pretty much categorized the different explanations into three different groups. The first is essentialist, or the nature argument, that women are just naturally different from men, and it might be because of millions of years of evolution, different evolutionary strategies. It might be because the distribution on math ability is slightly different for men than it is for women. But there are all these arguments that the differences in power between men and women come because of something that's born in us. Another category of explanations are the socialization theories, which say that we're not innately different, but we're socialized differently. So girls are taught to be nurturing and caring, and men are taught to be competitive and aggressive. And then there's finally the religious explanation, and that's the one I'm going to be talking about mostly today. A few years ago, the late President Hunter was asked if the church's position on women would ever change, and he said... he didn't think so because we follow the scripture on these matters, and the scriptures say certain things about women. So I would like to look at what the scriptures do say about women, and I'd like to go to the kind of penultimate for this topic, which is Genesis 3, verses 16 to 19. And a quick update for that one. God has created the world in the first chapter, and he created man and woman, and they've been placed in this beautiful garden and told they can eat from any tree except one. And at this point in the story, they've eaten from the tree, and God has found them out. And I'm going to skip what he says to the serpent, but this is what God says to them now they've been caught in this sin. Unto the woman, God said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrows. And this could also be translated pain or toil. And thy conception. In sorrow, pain or toil, thou wilt bring forth children. And thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And unto Adam he said, because you have hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree, of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In sorrow, pain or toil, shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it thou wast taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. Okay, so that's Genesis 3, 16 to 19. How have these verses been used by the churches to define God's will for the proper role of men and women? I see man's up here, woman's down there. Okay, so this hierarchy seems to be ordained by God. You will turn to your husband, and he will rule over you. Okay, so here we have from God's mouth, woman's place in the home rearing children, man in the workplace supporting his family by the sweat of his brow, and man ruling over his wife. So everything is explained. And the Mormon tradition would clarify this, is that women are just as capable as men, but they have been given different roles by God. And those roles are the same as those defined in Genesis 3. So some of the other religious explanations say that, you know, woman is morally depraved, and that's why we have this. And Mormonism doesn't say that. Now, a feminist scholar would say that the religious explanation is no more than a rationalization of the patriarchal oppression of women. But I think that Genesis 3 is key. I think it's absolutely correct. And I think even the details are there. For instance, how many curses are pronounced? Anyone? I know you don't have it in front of you. What is cursed? Yes. Exactly. The people are not cursed. The serpent, I didn't read that. The serpent is cursed and the ground is cursed. The cursed is the ground for thy sake, he says to Adam. So now the ground is cursed because of what the people have done, but the people themselves are not. But they're now mortal, and they live outside of God's abundance. And they're now going to be subject to laws, earthly laws, that they were not subject to before. And I believe that the main law that they're subject to at this point is economics. And so I want to talk about economics here. And this isn't going to sound like what you probably think economics sounds like. But economics is defined as the allocation of scarce resources among competing ends. And that's now what we have. We don't have abundance. We have things that are scarce. And we have different ways we want to use those resources. So it's economics. And I'm going to be calling a lot on Gary Becker, who wrote a book called A Treatise on the Family. And Becker won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, and he's very famous for applying economic principles to non-market behavior. So he looks at marriage, who you marry. He looks at who gets divorced. He looks at crime and the effect of punishment. He looks at addiction, things like this. Okay. And in economics terms, one person's competitive edge over the other is called their relative advantage. That's an important term to know. His model is very elegant because you don't have to posit millions of years of evolution like an essential theory or this massive social conspiracy, which is kind of at the base of socialization theories that we're socialized differently because, you know, men have been dominating women for all these years. But he starts out with a very simple assumption and then works the whole thing from that. And that is that man's advantage over woman comes from woman's competitive advantage. What is unique about woman? And so what is the one thing that females can do that no man has never done? They can bear children. Okay, so we're going to work this whole model from this. Now, traditionally, children have been a very valuable commodity. And children were valuable to men as well as women. You needed your child to help on the farm. You needed help with the cows. You needed children to take care of you when you were old. There was no Social Security. Most people had to work very hard all their lives just to survive. They couldn't put things aside for their old age. So children were very important. And women are the sole producers of children, and they're also the only ones who could feed them until, you know, relatively recently. If you didn't have a nursing mother for a baby, the baby would die. And also, for most of human history, child mortality was very high. So even wealthy families were lucky if they could reproduce themselves in a lot of these situations. So under these circumstances, women are very valuable as child rearers, and they're going to be more valuable in that role than in any other role. And note that when I talk about value throughout here, I'm not talking about honor. Okay, a cow may be valuable, but that doesn't mean they're honored. But this is kind of an economic thing that women are more valuable. Now, things have changed. I'm going to be talking about the traditional world just because we're coming out of that. I'm not sure they've changed that much, though. Okay, so thus, women become predominantly wives and mothers because they're more productive and rewarded in that role than any other and because they could do something else could do. Child-rearing then becomes woman's most important task. But throughout most of history, women have never had the option of just raising their children. They've had to do a lot of other work as well. And the sorrowful toil that Adam is condemned to, Eve is also condemned to as well. So she performs other tasks in addition to taking care of the children. And Becker notes that it's most efficient for mothers to perform tasks that are compatible with child-rearing. So women who have children are not going to become sailors and go out to sea. They're not going to do things that take them far away from their infants or places where they can't take their infants. So some of the traditional woman tasks where they kept the house, they prepared the food, and according to the Women's Bible Commentary, preparing grain for cooking alone could take up to 2 hours a day. Gardening, they kept the dairy animals, they farmed. Spinning was the consummate female task. because it was easy to put down when you needed to pick up a child. You could do it in the house. Okay. So even if women were bigger and stronger than men, they would still be more valuable at home because they can do something that the men can't do. And so by default, any work at which the woman doesn't have a comparative advantage becomes the man's work. Now, suppose that a particular woman has no real interest in being nurturing or being a mother. She still doesn't have any real choices in life in a traditional world. So even though she might not be biologically predisposed to childbearing or women's work, her parents don't know that when she's born, right? And so they're going to raise her for the traditional roles because that's more efficient. Education is expensive, and it's more efficient when you're required young. And education is especially expensive in past times. But I think that his model is actually more elegant than that. You don't need that assumption. And if you take a perverse example and work it through, you can see that training a girl to be a wife is a smart thing to do, even if education were free. And what I mean by a perverse example of this is, suppose there's some woman in a pre-industrialist society, and she decides that she doesn't want to be a wife and mother. She wants to enter the marketplace. And this isn't completely unreasonable, because even in a subsistence economy, there were jobs that did not depend on brute strength alone. That upper body strength here. So a woman might find an occupation where she could excel despite being on average smaller than a man. Perhaps trade, law, philosophy, education. She could become a chef, right? And suppose that she also acquired the necessary skills and she had financial support. And let's make it even easier for her and assume that she doesn't have to deal with discrimination or sexual harassment or fears of being assaulted or whatever. Under these optimal circumstances, then, is she better off in the marketplace than she would be in a domestic role? Probably not. Because a man with similar circumstances, even a man with significantly less valuable market skills than this woman, can still have children and a domestic partner. And in fact, Becker says that if men are relieved of all domestic responsibilities, that makes them even better equipped to compete in the marketplace. Okay. So having a domestic partner in the more traditional sense, perhaps not in the contemporary one, was a very valuable resource because food did not just appear on the table. Clothing was not something you could go down to the store and buy. You needed somebody at home to produce these things. So our woman is at a disadvantage already because she doesn't have anyone to take care of her domestically. Now, she could live with her mother or hire servants, you know, pay someone else to do this, but neither provide her with other valuable resources available to the married man, such as a sexual relationship and children. Now, the independent woman could marry to acquire these resources, although it would be hard for her to compete with the domestically specialized women. But she would find that men who are trained for the marketplace make very poor wives, and they have no advantage in childbearing. So in addition to losing the benefits of having a domestic partner, the non-traditional woman can have a romantic relationship only if it doesn't involve sex. So, you know, if the man is willing to hang around without sex, she can have romance. But in a world without reliable birth control, sex leads to children, and once the woman has children, she's back in the home because she's more valuable there, right? Okay, so this is what I mean by a perverse example. So if our pioneering woman wants to remain in the marketplace, then she has to give up a domestic partnership, marriage, sex, and children. So the man or the traditional housewife has all of these benefits of marriage. But the woman who tries to specialize in the market, even under the best of circumstances, gives up a major portion of the resources that are available to her otherwise. And it's not that the woman can't compete with men or that she's not competent to do this work, but that she can't compete with her own alternatives. Her own alternatives provide her with more than seeking a non-traditional role. And so marketplace activities require the traditional woman to give up too much personally. And usually the only women who engaged in non-domestic activities were those who didn't have women's resources available to them. For instance, they never married or because their husbands were absent. They were dead at war, traveling on trade or in jail. And she writes this wonderful book about a midwife who takes care of everything and runs her own business and is very independent, but her husband's in jail. Okay, so men's competitive advantage against women in the workplace comes not only from their physical strength, but from their ability to marry women. Okay, given that boys are being trained for the marketplace and girls are being trained for domestic work, what personal characteristics will be valued in boys? If you know that your son is going to have to go out there and work in the marketplace, what are parents going to want their boys to be? Aggressive, ambitious, competitive. Anything else? Educated, intelligent. Okay, so we've got this whole list of things that boys are supposed to be. Encouraged to strive for power. They're going to want them to have a drive to subdue and master. They're going to be self-centered, task-oriented, insensitive, tough. Okay. Now, the daughters are competing for the best domestic jobs, that is, the best husbands. So they want to marry men who can support them well and who will bring resources into her family, or at least not take them out. So what characteristics are you going to value in the daughters? Beauty. Submissiveness. She's going to want to be pleasing. Anything else? Fertility. Yes? Not overly intelligent. Don't question authority. All right, so yeah, great. These are the things I have. You're going to want your daughters in this kind of situation to be skilled at attracting and pleasing, to be nurturing, sweet, accommodative, sensitive, patient, socially aware, to love beautiful things, and to be interested in children. Yes, please. To be able to put up with, the ability to be able to put up with this man who's been socialized this other way. And some people would say that women were traditionally manipulative, and that may be the same kind of thing. You have to put up with him, and you have to make him feel like he's the top dog all the time. So from the very beginning of their lives, girls are valued for very different things than the boys are, even though their innate personality dispositions and capacities might be identical to their brothers. Okay. So this has a lot of implications for the relative power between men and women. Boys are valued and trained to roles that lead to power, that lead to dominance, that lead to competition, whereas girls are raised to be competitive only when it comes to attracting men. Okay. And in addition, Becker notes that women in these roles become what he calls domestically specialized. And by that he means that her value is to one man and one household. And it's going to be very difficult for a wife to change employers. It's going to totally disrupt her life. Now, she could go and be a servant in someone else's house, but she'll be a servant there, not the mistress of the household. In contrast, the market skills of the husband, even if he's just a peasant, he has value to a wide number of employers. He can change jobs more easily than she can. So the broader base of demand for male labor gives the man more power in the relationship, because it's going to be easier for her to replace him, for him to replace her, than for her to replace him. Okay, so it's easier for him to find another job than it is her to find another husband and father for her children. Okay, so in summary, because children are valuable, women are most valuable as child bearers, and she becomes domestically specialized, the men become specialized to the marketplace, and we have all of these different qualities that result because of these different demands on them. And men have more power, and women are raised not to want power. Now, do you see the parallels between the picture of this economic fallen world and Genesis 3? Okay. We've got woman condemned to sorrowful toil, and so economically women have to work. In Genesis, we have woman bringing forth children in sorrow. In reality, we have women being valued for childbearing. Genesis 3, we have the woman turning to her husband. In reality, we have girls being raised to be dependent and concerned about attracting and pleasing men of all the feminine charms. We have the husband ruling over the wife in Genesis 3, and in reality, we have the wife with less power than her husband and the rule of men in general. Moving to the man's curse, or the man's statement, it's not a curse. The curse on the ground, the thorns, economic scarcity in the real world. The man is condemned to sorrowful toil in Genesis 3, and of course men must work to survive in the real world. In Genesis 3 we have man eating bread by the sweat of his brow, and I think that's an allusion to the anxiety, the concerns about competition, the horrible burdens that men live with when you always have to be the best, you always have to compete. And then we have man and woman returning to the dust. We have death. Okay. And, of course, the nature of Adam and the woman's relationship changes immediately after the fall. Only after the fall does Adam name the woman. Now, before, when God presented woman to them, he said, "This is someone like me." She will be called woman because she was taken out of man. It was saying, "This is someone who's like me." But after the fall, he names her Eve, which is a reference to her biological role. And Eve needs the mother of all living. Okay, so their relationships becomes a matter of economics. And that's the allocation of scarce resources among competing ends. And it doesn't matter how much Adam and Eve love each other, or how committed they are to equal rights, or how much they remember the oneness to which they were created. They have to allocate resources efficiently, or they will die. And as we've seen, the efficient allocation includes gender roles, which God tells them is a consequence of mortality. Now, seen in this light, is Genesis 3 an expression of God's will? Is this what he created them to be? Is this what he wants them to be? Anyone willing to vote for that alternative? Okay, I think when you really look at Genesis 3, this is a description that God tells them, this is the consequences of living outside my abundance. You want to go your own way. These are the consequences. This is what's going to happen to you now. The people aren't cursed. It's not their basic nature that's changed, but the ground is cursed. So the economic realities in which they're living has changed. Where we've gone wrong, I think, is in reifying the concept of gender. And to reify means to take an idea or concept and treat it as if it were real. And gender is not real. If I can borrow what someone said in a previous session, gender is not a principle of the gospel. Gender is reality. Gender is the real world. But the forces that create it are so powerful that it's hard not to view it as something real. And it's really hard to overcome them. But God created sex. In the beginning, he creates the male and female. But he didn't create all these gender roles. So they don't reflect his will, but they're a result of the fall. And if we try to be obedient to norms and ideals that are not godly at all, but a response to economic competition against each other, then we cling to the anxieties that come from being a man or a woman. We're being obedient to a curse, not God's will. And we think that we're being righteous when, in fact, we're propagating sin. And think for a minute of all the things that our culture considers a successful man to be. He's rich, he's powerful, he's never wrong, he's masterful. And a successful woman is thin and beautiful and well-dressed, and maybe she's really skilled at getting her own way without making the man feel threatened. Yes, we have the total woman here. And there's no religious content to any of those things. Yes, please.
It's very distressing to marriage. I was once in marriage counseling that it's impossible to achieve intimacy where you have the birth of the situation. And so it's really distressing.
For the tape, this lady said she was a marriage counselor, and it's impossible to achieve intimacy in marriage when you have the men striving for these things and the women striving for those. And I agree. Okay, but don't we admire people who are successful? And don't we feel guilty that we aren't as successful? And when you're with, I'm staying with a friend of mine from high school, and it's like, well, you know, is she more successful than I am? Or is my house bigger than hers? I live in San Jose. I don't know, it's not. And don't we feel shamed and envious when we're with people who fulfill their roles better than we do? Don't we feel an obligation to be that way, too, that we're somehow lacking in virtue if we're not thin and beautiful or rich and powerful? But for us to strive to achieve worldly gender ideals is to become more anxious, more subject to the curse, and less like God. Unless a whole human being. Now, I'm going to have to skip a part here, but I think if you go back to creation accounts before Genesis 3, before the curse, before sin enters the world, you'll see a completely different relationship between the man and the woman. You start out with them being created in God's image, male and female. you've got a situation where Adam is alone and he's incomplete until he has a mate who is like him, and that's what the help meet in the King James Version translate as a help who is like him. And the narrative continues quite beautifully. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife and be one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. And various people have pointed out that this last verse describes not just their physical state of being naked, but the state of their relationship too. So being naked and unashamed means that you can be completely open and honest with this other person. There's no fear, no embarrassment, no worries about how you look, about how you come across, no game playing, no roles, no concerns about being shown up or offending someone's fragile ego, just total intimacy of those between whom there are no barriers. And I believe that as Christ redeems us from death, he also redeems us from gender. And that's pretty explicit in the New Testament, if you know how to read the New Testament. A couple of years ago at Sunstone, you had a speaker named Scott Barchi who gave a fabulous talk. And I've got I found one copy of his tape out there, which I've got. If anyone wants it, I will sell it to you. But that would be a good start to really understanding what Jesus and Paul were saying about the relationship between men and women. But I think ultimately it comes down to this wonderful, wonderful thing that Paul says, is there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you're all one in Christ. So no worldly economic status has any meaning in Christ. And you also see the end of the curse very explicit in John's revelation of the holy city, in the Revelation, the last book in the Bible, in which are recreated the circumstances of the Garden of Eden. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be among them and be their God, and God will wipe away every tear from their eye, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away, and there shall be no more curse. Okay. So if Christ redeems us from this, if these are not godly roles, it's a whole different take on the world. Now, I'm not saying that you don't need money or that you don't need to be attractive. Unfortunately, you do. I think the way that the world has changed is so that these anxieties are more equally distributed, and men are worrying more about being attractive than they used to, and women are worrying about being successful and competitive. You can wear lipstick and high heels, all right? Do what you need to do, but don't think that is who you are, or that is what God made you for. Now, if this were a Protestant Christian audience, then my talk would end here. But with Mormons, we have a bit of a complication, and that is that we have not only reified the concept of gender, in a lot of ways we've deified it, because we have, you know, the notion of the married couple becoming gods, and we have a mother in heaven by implication. I gave my paper the subtitle, Why Mother in Heaven Can't Save You, because I don't believe that historically feminine gods have worked to women's advantage. Mother in Heaven is a very difficult concept, because other Christians can change their minds about what God wants. Mormons have to change their minds about who God is. So I say we deify gender as well as not just reify it. There have always been female deities. In the Old Testament, the judges and the prophets were continuously battling the people's worship of Ashtaroth. And if you read the Old Testament, they're always going down and cutting down the Ashtaroth poles. Ashtaroth was a female fertility god, and everyone had one of these poles in their backyard. The Greek and the Roman pantheon was full of female gods. The great Artemis of Ephesus was a female. But the worship of female gods usually turned out to be the worship of female biology. These were fertility cults. And the temples of the female gods were the only places where they had the cultic prostitution. The male gods did not have temple prostitutes. Diana, for some reason, Artemis, who is a virgin, is the place for all of the prostitutes. And men would go there and seek spirituality through sexual ecstasy with these enslaved women temple prostitutes. Okay, so I think as modern readers, we have to be careful not to project the Judaic Christian God onto pagan worship patterns. The Greco-Roman gods, for instance, were not concerned about people. They were busy with their own little intrigues. You didn't want to attract their attention. If you were an attractive female and you attracted Zeus's attention, he would come and rape you, probably. Aphrodite might get jealous and zap you in some way. So humans generally did not particularly want to attract the gods' attention, and the worship was more like trying to bribe the gods or trying to propitiate them so that they wouldn't zap them. So goddess worship was often not the worship of a transcendent loving mother who lifted women up, but was an attempt to assure the continuous provision of women's biological resources, sex and children. Now, I doubt if Mormons in the 20th century are going to get into anything too kinky in honoring Mother in Heaven, but what little has been said of her suggests the same pagan tendency to see the female gods only in terms of female biology. So although some of the recent descriptions of her are, she's the ultimate maternal modesty, restrained, queenly elegance, gracious, maternal, dignified, putting on a really good party to welcome us home. These are just reifications or deifications of 19th century Victorian feminine ideals. And in addition, we have a list of what she's not. She's not male, she's not powerful, she's not God the Father, she's not a priesthood folder, she's not to be named or prayed to, she doesn't speak. And so when you start defining the female in terms of differences from the male and isolating her to that, then like Eve, God the mother is stripped of her wholeness and named only in terms of her biological stereotypic functions, and she's the mother of all living, like Eve. And perhaps this is why some LDS women feel such pain in living in a motherless house. We've spent our lives trying to contain ourselves within the gender box, but there's not enough room for a whole person within these gender roles, let alone a god within these roles. And if you're too much, if you're too intelligent, if you're too aggressive, too competitive, then you certainly don't fit in the box. And I have to say that this applies to men as well as women. We need to strip gender of its claim to morality and to project either femininity or masculinity as we know it onto God is a mistake. If we speak of God as only in the masculine, it's perhaps because we don't understand a metaphor. Where are we here? Sorry. We don't understand metaphors or how poetry is used in scriptures. And the wholeness is God, the both sides. God is not exclusively masculine in the scriptures. And it's right there if you look for it. You know, as Mormons, if you study the Joseph Smith story or anything, you know there's Elohim and Jehovah, these two different names for God that inspired Joseph Smith to led him to some of his revelations. We have Elohim and Jehovah as different names for gods in the Old Testament. But there are other names for gods in there. El Shaddai, El Elyon, El Olam Adonai, Jehovah Sabaoth, and a lot of others. And Father is only one name that's masculine identity, and that's scarcely used at all in the Old Testament. And it's in the New Testament, it's used mostly by Jesus. The epistle writers hardly use that at all. And not all images of God in the Bible are masculine. The wisdom of God in Proverbs is feminine. And a particularly intriguing example of feminine imagery is El Shaddai, one of the other names for God. And this is the name that God uses with Abraham. And the name is usually translated as the Almighty or the God of the Mountain. But Shaddai means mountain the same way that Grand Tetons means mountain. Anyone speak French and you know what Grand Tetons mean? Because Shaddai comes from Shad, which is the Hebrew word meaning a woman's breast. And therefore, El Shaddai means the breasted one. And when the Almighty appears in the first chapter of Revelation, I am the Alpha and Omega, he is wearing a long robe to the ground, and he's got a golden girdle under his paps, is how it is translated in the King James Version. But the robe that they describe is a woman's robe. And the breasts, the word for breasts that they use, are the word for a woman's breasts. So you have the Almighty appearing in the Revelation, as well as in Genesis, as the breasted one. Now, does this mean that God has breasts? Have we found God the Mother? Or, as Juke suggests, is the name of God a metaphor, best translated as the pour forth, the nourisher, the satisfier, the all-sufficient one, the God who is everything to Abraham? Are we taking things too literally? Is there the imagery right under our nose? God is more than Jehovah, who carries a sword. He's more than the breasted one. But these are important ways of looking at God. In any case, the Bible is full of imagery for God, male, female, and inanimate. God is my rock, for instance. And to take any of them literally and exclusively robs them of their wholeness. So when Jesus calls God Abba, which is the word that's translated Father, this isn't the formal Father, you know, the reified Father, the patriarch, but it's Papa, or dearest Father. It's a term so intimate and warm that one scholar suggests it should be translated Mother Father. Okay? So when Jesus calls God Abba, he invites us into a new type of relationship with this abstract and transcendent God of the Jews, and to insist that Jesus addressed God as Father because God was literally his physical parent and nobody else's, and because God was literally male and only male, leaves us outside of that warmth and intimacy. And that's certainly not what Jesus intended to do. What Jesus intended to do was to offer us redemption, to buy us back from sin and death to oneness with each other, with him, and with God. The marriage of the Lamb and his bride, the church, is the one flesh union of Genesis 2, not the economic partnership of Genesis 3. But we can't be one with anyone if we continue to enslave ourselves to the consequences of the curse. And it's only by accepting our full salvation, giving up our fears, our competitions, our advantages, our roles and manipulations, that we can return to the oneness for which God created us.
Our next presenter is Margaret Merrill Toscano. Margaret has a master's in classics from BYU and has taught Greek, Latin, literature, mythology, and humanities. Margaret also works with the Mormon Women's Forum. And I might mention that the Women's Forum is going to have a symposium in November, so you might watch for that. Margaret's currently working on her doctoral dissertation to complete her PhD in comparative literature and languages at the University of Utah. The title of her dissertation, Making Love with God, Sex and Power in Mystical Discourse. So you can imagine how her committee is going to deal with that. Marital relationships and perceptions of God.
I want to begin with an excerpt from a poem by Erica Young. Mothers and daughters, something sharp catches in my throat as I watch my mother, nervous before flight, do needlepoint, blue irises and yellow daffodils against a stippled woolen sky. She pushes the needle in and out as she once pushed me, sharp needle to the canvas of her life, embroidering her faults in prose and poetry, writing the fiction of my bitterness, the poems of my need. You hate me, she accuses, needle poised. Why not admit it? I shake my head. The air is thick with love gone bad, the odor of old blood. If I were small enough, I would suck your breast, but I say nothing, big mouth filled with poems. Mother, what I feel for you is more and less than love. When I have mentioned the title of my paper, If I Hate My Mother, Can I Love the Heavenly Mother, to different women, they have usually responded with a startled, Do you really hate your mother? Their response has surprised me a little because I thought of my title as rhetorical, not confessional. However, I think the question is still appropriate because feminism always sees theological questions arising out of personal experience. In this paper, I mix personal narrative with theological analysis, not only because I see this as effective methodology, but also because my thesis assumes that all of our theological constructs are based on personal and cultural preference. Although my paper explores my relationship with my own mother, I felt defensive when women asked me if I hated my mother because their question seemed to imply that if I do, I may not be the good person they thought me to be. So perhaps I should begin by assuring you that I do not hate my mother. With Erica Young, I think I can say that what I feel for her is more and less than love. I am not close to her, but I feel deeply rooted to her. I seldom talk to her, but I think about her often. I sometimes feel angry at her passivity and denial, but I am also deeply sympathetic to her pain and struggles. There are many things I admire about her, but I am also afraid of becoming like her. At times, when I catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror, when I have not thought to pose, I can see her in my face, and I shudder. While ambivalence is closer to what I feel about my mother than hate, in this paper I want to focus more on my negative images of the mother figure. In describing a painful encounter, I hope to show a process for healing. The importance of understanding my dark feelings became clear to me because of a dream I had several years ago. In the dream, I'm sitting in an outdoor cafe with a group of women from the Mormon Women's Forum. We are worried about what the church is going to do to us. Some of the women keep saying that there is a man who is coming to destroy us and that we must be careful. I am sitting quietly, not knowing whether to believe this or not. As we sit there, we see a huge, imposing, and frightening figure approaching us. "Here he comes," scream the women. But as the figure comes nearer, I can see that it is not a man, but a very large woman, at least three times the size of a normal person. She is dressed in black like a witch out of a fairy tale, even down to the broom she is carrying. As she rushes toward us, the other women all begin to point at me and shout, "She's the one to blame. It's not us you want. Get her." The witch whirls around toward me and begins to beat me ferociously with her broom. It is excruciatingly painful. I try to protect myself against her blows with my hands, but it does no good. As I cower beneath her, I look up at her hooded face. To my great surprise, I see my mother's face. When I awoke from this dream, I was sweating and shaking and too frightened to go back to sleep. It was like a childhood nightmare. In the days following the dream, I thought about it often. What seemed the most significant was the witch figure who was my mother. It absolutely astonished me. What could it mean? My own mother was never cruel. She was the absent mother, not the devouring one. Why did she appear like this in my dream? Why was she so violent? As I meditated on the dream, I realized I had never dealt with my anger at my mother for the ways I had felt abandoned by her. I had always tried to understand her and excuse her. I had even taken over the mothering role. I could be strong, even if she was not. Because I did not feel mothered, protected, or nurtured by her, I gave up all desire for a mother. I wanted to nurture others, but I was uncomfortable with anyone nurturing me. I realized that even in my search for a female god, I was put off by the mother image. I wanted a goddess, a strong female god, but not a mother god. Like my real mother, the heavenly mother seemed to have withdrawn into the bedroom to sleep. She seemed invisible and powerless like her daughters. A series of questions began to occur to me. If I hate my mother, can I love the heavenly mother? If mother, can I love myself? If I hate God, can I love myself? If I hate myself, can I love my mother or the heavenly mother? I wanted to put these questions in the sharpest terms possible. Love, hate. There was no room for ambivalence at this point. I had to let myself feel my strongest and darkest feelings about my mother, about myself, and about God. I began to see the various ways all of these relationships are intertwined. Of course, making these connections is not a new idea. Ever since the advent of depth psychology, it has been commonplace to see our relationships with our parents as crucial for working out our self-identity. Jewish scholar Howard Alberg Schwartz has noted, "If we agree with nothing else from Freud, he was certainly right about the ways in which divine and parental images are entangled. And the possibility of connecting to divine images, whether male or female, clearly is related to the relationships we have to our fathers and mothers." Depth psychology has, of course, been used to undercut belief in God by treating religion as merely a projection of and wish for an ideal. I find it intriguing, therefore, that in some contemporary theology, God images are also being discussed now because they are a way people have of working through their notions of the ideal and the good in the process of constructing a self and a society. The thesis of this paper is that self-understanding cannot come without an examination of our God images, whether we consider ourselves believers or not. For the non-believer, such an examination forces the acknowledgement that disbelief is formed as much by personal preference and metaphor as it is by evidence. For the believer, it forces the acknowledgement that the reality of God does not eliminate the possibility that projection and cultural metaphors are involved in creating our perceptions about God. Now, I happen to be a believer. I have tried very hard not to be, but I cannot help it. I have faith that God is real. But even if I am right about this, and of course I have doubts, I still know that my pictures of God are incomplete and colored by my own desires, fears. Knowing God, like knowing ourselves, is a lifetime process and more. Joseph Smith's statement has always fascinated me. If men do not comprehend the character of God, they do not comprehend themselves. And I think the opposite is true, too. Knowing ourselves is the first step toward knowing God. Do we want a personal God? Do we want a God without a personality, one who is simply a loving force or a power for good? Do we want a male God, a female God, or both? Or maybe we want an androgynous God. Do we want one God, two gods, three, a pantheon? Do we reject the idea of God altogether because it feels like a foolish, unscientific projection? Or maybe we reject God because the last thing we want is another authority figure. Whatever seems superior to us, whatever belief or non-belief appeals to us, reveals something about what we perceive as the ideal. It shows us something about our deepest desires and perhaps our deepest conflicts. I love the following passage from James Smiley's satirical novel, Moo, because it deals so subtly with the way our experiences shape our pictures of God and goodness. The character Marley in this passage, who belongs to an evangelical Christian group and is a cafeteria worker at the local university, has decided to leave town and her fiancé. She had changed because she was tired of Jesus. The way he came to you and sat with you, the way he had to be a man in order to be human. Everybody in her church was always talking about how happy it made them that Jesus was right there at your elbow, helping you along and keeping you on the right path. What could be better than a personal savior? But Marley resented the way Jesus counted on you needing him like that. He never stepped back. He always wanted something from you. You always had to do something to please him. She came to the top of the hill. The road beside her continued up over the bridge. The snowy drift at her feet spread away like a giant apron past the highway below and into the dark filigree of the woods beyond. The grandeur of it was peaceful and soothing. She felt invited into the picture, perhaps noticed, but not focused on. Jesus, she thought, was back in town, nosing into everybody's concerns. But God was here, large and beautiful, and satisfyingly impersonal. As I have thought about the ways our experiences are intertwined with our pictures of God, I have realized that dealing with my negative images of the mother figure, human or divine, was important for me if I was going to understand some of the things I don't like about myself. It was important for me, if I was going to figure out some of my own ambivalent feelings about being both a daughter and a mother. And it was crucial if I was going to understand the ways in which I have a hard time relating to God. I have argued on many occasions that the mother-female God is crucial for the healing and empowerment of women. Jewish, Christian, and even secular women have said the same thing many times. We all recall that much-used phrase, when God is man, man is God. I still believe that a concept of a female God is essential for the equality of women. However, I've also come to believe that a female God creates problems for women, too. Like any good thing, there is always a shadow side. Last year, I discovered a book called God's Phallus and Other Problems for Men and Monotheism. When you're writing about God and sex for your dissertation, you find these things. Written by Howard Eilberg Schwartz. In this book, Eilberg Schwartz says that he has been influenced by feminist theologians and agrees with them that a male image of God validates male experience at the expense of women. He says that for a time this made him reject a father God figure altogether until he began to sense his own need.